have the language. I mean, yeah. Some of them don't. You know, that it's something like one of the girls was talking. She never heard anything else until she went to school.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I guess that group, when they went to school and they learned English, then they came home. When they had children, they spoke English in the home. So we've got a generation or so in there that doesn't, there's many of them don't speak the language as they'd like. So I think that we've probably, in my opinion, they saw the peak of actually, you know, no real cultural influence to you know, it was being bombarded, to use one of James's terms, you know, by the non-Indian culture. It was being taken over. Now the focus is back to, we live in the non-Indian world, and we you know, it's part of us. It's something we have to learn to do, but we don't have to give up or forget the things that we were doing. So he has put a lot of emphasis on, he's funded a cultural heritage program. It's had several names, but where they're actually teaching the children the different languages. They've written the language. The Creek group up in Brighton, I think you may have seen some of them. I think I have one or two here. Little books that they wrote for the children, you know, with the colors and so forth in the language. And this was really cute because one day I laughed. I said, I can't believe this council meeting. One day they gave all the councilmen a piece of paper in the language that the councilman speaks, and they had to decide what color they needed to color this piece of paper with. You know, this was one of the projects. They were just showing them one of the things they were doing. So they had to be able to read their language to know what the color was. So that was real cute. And that's one of the things they're doing with the small children. And they've got a real good, you know, I think they've got a good project going, but seems that every time he turns around, he's saying, record this and save that. And he has just, I hired a girl that's doing some audiovisual work, and he's saying, go to Lena Frank, Ethel's mother, and let her tell the stories and get a certain setting, and don't edit it. I don't want to edit it. You know, I want it just the way she tells it, and you know, just different things like that, that it's very important to him. So I think this is, this would be something that he would appreciate, would be the fact that it, yeah.
Right. And we've, originally we were thinking of focusing in on basketry, but we've been starting to think about maybe focusing in on patchwork, since it's such a distinctive Seminole craft. It seems that no other Indian.
We thought not either. I could probably go in there and find it in the trash. I think I threw it away this morning. We got a brochure from some group selling some different things, and when we looked at it, and Lottie across the room says, oh, Seminole apron. But it was sewn by a Comanche. So I don't know if some of the other Indian tribes are picking up the patchwork
from
as it be, I can find. I'll find it for you. I know it's in the trash in there, because I was real surprised because it was things from different tribes.
Let me ask you just.
Let me ask one question.
I can speak into the mic when I need.
breaker.
Okay. My question was.
No, you don't have to be fight that puppy.
Okay.
My question was, in the past year or so, a lot of interest all around the United States has been given to Seminole patchwork, and I know that recently, probably within the past 2 years, a group of white women came down and studied the patchwork here on the reservation and produced a book, and I'm curious to know how the tribe feels about this particular book, which was called Seminole Patchwork from Traditional Methods to Contemporary Uses.
I don't really know. I was not here when this was done. I was with the tribe, but not here in this office. James Billy's picture appears in that. So
I'm very familiar with the book. I have the book. I thought they did a good job with it, but I've heard Ethel and various ones, as you know, we've been talking just informally, that expressed some dissatisfaction against someone from the outside coming in and presenting this.
Okay, I think the tribe as a whole probably feels that way, because they're still Well, I guess this is the way I say it. The battle of the cowboys and Indians is still there. You know, the war may be over, but the fight's still on. The people still have their reservations about the non-Indian person, and they don't really want the non-Indian that involved in the things that they're doing, even here in the workforce. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. They would love, I mean, I don't know how many of them out there would give me the time of day, but they would be just very happy if there were if an Indian girl was sitting in this position. You know, that's the way they feel. It's a deep down thing, and yeah. I think those of us who have been here for a while can appreciate that. You know, it's
right. I guess I'm wondering too, like with those who do patchwork and have seen this book come out, has that given the tribe something to think about in terms of? This is part of our identity. What can we do to sell? Has it made any changes?
I don't think that there are that many of the people that are that far developed yet. Now, again, this is my own personal opinion, but I think that thought that you have may be down the road 5 years.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But right now, they're still battling. You know, they're battling to stay afloat this non-Indian dominant culture, you know,
right.
And I think that's one of those things that's so low on the priority list.
Well, I want to ask how did you end up? You're the assistant to the chairman.
Secretary,
and how did you?
Still
find
trying to
this
figure that
job.
Out myself. No, my background is health.
Uh-huh.
And I started to work with the tribe with the health program. Joel Frank was the health planner and was looking for a secretary. I applied for that job and got it. And because of the experience that I had, one of the things they wanted to do was contract their health program, which was being run by Indian Health Service. So I had the knowledge to do that. So I wrote the proposal and ran their contract health program for a year and a half or so. And then there were some problems over here. He had gotten rid of both of the girls that worked for him, or they quit, or whatever the situation was. And he approached me one day and said, would you consider coming to work for me? And I said, yeah, I'll think about it. So the next day he called me in and said, you're starting tomorrow, right? I said, take your head, yes. Yes, I'm starting tomorrow. So here I am. And I spent the first 3 months, I think, feeling like someone had nailed one foot to the floor and somebody else had just given me a spin.
Yeah.
But things are starting to settle down now.
Well, how long have you been working?
4 years. I've been
years.
With the tribe 4 years, and I've been here in this office since March of last year.
Are you from this area, or
no,
did you
I'm
move
from
down?
West Virginia. I moved from Virginia, but I was born and raised in West Virginia. Lived in Virginia for 13 years, mm-hmm. and then became a Florida transplant.
Well, when we were talking to Ethel, too, you were talking about the, you know, survival in the white man's world. Immokalee is even more mixed up, I mean, in terms of cultural influence, in terms of Mexican, and, you know, there's the Hispanic influence, the white influence, and a lot of black migrant workers.
Mm-hmm.
And then a tiny, tiny Seminole reservation. And
James Billy's comments about the tiny reservation is he's got to get a bigger land base out there, because these Indian boys, when they lay down to sleep at night, their feet are hanging over the sides of the reservation. He says, those people keep falling off that reservation. I've got to get more land.
Ethel mentioned that they were trying to get more land because, well, actually they are. They're just, right, you know, 5 acres or something.
Yeah, it's
right
4
there.
Point something, yeah.
And I was just wondering if that's had an do you know if that's had pretty much of an effect on, say, the Indians in Immokalee? Are they different from the others?
The Indians in Immokalee are an independent group, I think. And I think that when you go back to how they started in the first place, I'm sure Ethel told you the story, that the Indian women, now this is from the way I remember it, you can ask her and get her to tell you, but the Indian women that married or mated with a non-Indian, there was a time when they were not allowed to live on the reservation. Now, Indian man could marry a non-Indian woman and bring her on the reservation, but an Indian woman, if she married a non-Indian man, she had to go off the reservation. She was not. There was a period, and some of the women that are still here are very bitter over this situation. Well, I think when Ethel's mother and father, whatever their relationship was, the mother, when she left, I think with somebody, you know, Spanish person or something, and they settled in this small, it was, I think, a citrus grove or a farm of some sort. They worked as migrant workers. So as more of the women met with non-Indian men, they had to leave, so they would go. They ended up in a group. In other words, that reservation kind of ended up as a woman's group, woman's reservation. You know, they were kind of excommunicated from the tribe here. Mm-hmm. And I guess being strong women to start with, the reservation itself is strong. I think it's strong.
Right. I think Ethel was a great example of that strength.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I understand her mother is very, very strong, you know, a very influential person there. And I think the other women, you know, some of them may not be as strong of personalities, but I think the spirit mm-hmm. of strength is really there. And the things that they've accomplished, and the things that I've been able to see now, this reflects somewhat on Ethel, but I think she and Nancy McIntyre both have right. kind of been the designated leaders of that reservation. When I came here, they didn't even have a representative on the council. They still don't have a voting right, but those girls raised hell. And they're both, now Ethel's on the board. She doesn't have a vote, but she's got a voice. I mean, she's there, you know, and she's mm-hmm. observant, and she's able to carry back, and she's influential, you know. And this, like the same thing with Nancy. And I laugh because if you want to see some firefly, now you just try to cheat a mockery out of something. You're going to see hit the fan, because those girls, and they'll take on anybody. You know, I mean, they're really strong. That's one of the reasons they've been able to accomplish things they've got. They've been able to get programs over there. I was here when they were fighting about the smoke shop, mm-hmm, you know, sure. that. They wanted to set it up with the reservation not getting a portion of the revenue. It would go into a general revenue pot. And I think, now I may be wrong, but I think that I know they fought for it, and I think they won it, that they get a certain percentage that goes into their little revenue, their little reservation kitty, mm-hmm. you know, for things that they want to do over there. And they've gotten a recreation van and representatives on different programs. Seminole Princess just came from, is now from that reservation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's, you can see, it's small, and it's 4.5 acres or whatever. Honey, that 4.5 acres is packed with dynamite. You know, they're just.
We could kind of sense that mm-hmm. because it did seem that. Well, first of all, one thing we noticed was that we didn't see any men on the reservation much at all. It was all women, and they're all busy. Mm-hmm. They were busy. In the crafts area, you know, there are women working there, and then in the main office, women in and out. But I think I only saw two Indian men, and they were kind of working on the construction, but they were young
uh-huh.
and kind of looked like maybe they were the sons
children,
of...
Children, yes, they probably were. I don't know, now that you mentioned it, I don't know if there is an Indian head of household over there. Maybe Victor Frank, which is Ethel's brother.
Yeah.
That's right, and she did say her brother settled there, that's right.
And there's not many.
But see, he was the son of her mother.
Yeah,
so you know,
there.
As they, I'm sure there'll be more as they raise more children. But the houses they're building are really nice. I mean, really, and you know, they were very, very much into the struggle to get more land. And she did say that first she got a reference. She wants to get eventually. She says we're going to have a recreation hall, and we're going to have this, and we're going to have that.
They will
everything. That, you know, the other reservations have, they will get it, I'm
they
sure.
They will.
But she was saying also that before they do anything, they need more land because there'd be no place to put it.
I think that one of the things that they talked about one time was a gymnasium.
Oh.
And they said, well, where would we put it?
Mm-hmm.
And they've been very pushy, you know, to the mm-hmm. chairman to be able to get the deal put together and get, a land base there. I don't think they want to go far from where they are.
Mm-hmm.
The gentleman that owned that land did will or willed it, the family deeded it to those women.
Huh.
And that's how that became a federal, you know, they federalized the property, and it became a federal reservation. Until then, they couldn't spend, like those houses now are HUD houses. Well, ordinarily, they would not have been able to have gotten HUD houses mm-hmm. because it was land that would have belonged to someone else. So,
what was that, 79 when that actually happened?
I think so. I think it was 79 when they federalized it. I came in 78 and... yeah, it was 79. It was federalized.
It's really interesting because in history, most of the southeastern Indian tribes and most Native American tribes were matriarchal in society. I mean, you trace your lineage, and you still do, through your mother,
yes.
not your father.
Yeah.
And the women really were much more influential in family life and also economics,
that's,
and they owned all
today.
The property and all that. And I know that still is happening, but with as more and more contact with white society is going on, do you see that there may be a change over to the...
Well, I guess I have to laugh because to me, I'm not a women's liber, you know,
uh-huh.
per se, But I think that the women are very strong. The men, we've got a few macho men, you know, that'll walk around strutting. But the mothers can jerk these boys in line so fast. I mean, you know, I'm talking about 35-year-old men that's mothers are around, you know. And I think that the women still are very, very strong. I don't think the men, I mean, James Billy's an exception to the rule, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's a real strong male individual, you know, but I think the women still. It's not advertised as much, you know what I'm saying,
yeah.
But the men would like it to be another way, but I think uh-huh. it's one of those things that when the woman speaks, really speaks, they listen, I think.
It's interesting because I could tell that Ethel is kind of sly like a fox, because we asked her kind of the same question about whether she felt the women... Or the men was the head of the household, and she said, "Oh, the men are," and you know, it was kind of like I kept on going, "Really?" You know, because
in her case,
from
it may
all
be.
We observed,
I don't
think
that
so. Was not
no.
true.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like, well, if you keep telling them that they are,
yeah. Well, you know, I think no. again that's the that's another part of their subdued power in a way. I think that probably is. They don't walk around. The women don't walk around, you know. They're very meek looking little women. And I'm telling you, honey, you be around here sometime during politics time.
Oh.
I mean, not really that they're not that they're not out campaigning. I'm not saying that. But you can tell the women that everybody wants to stay nice to. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think they're still very, very strong.
Yeah.
And I think in the households they're very strong. Because the men still somewhat come and go, I think.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're the woman's there and the kids are there. But, you know, he may be here today and the next
uh-huh.
camp tomorrow,
yeah.
you know. And I think that the women still have that strength.
Yeah. Well, in history, of course, that was the way the man goes to live with the wife and her family. And that's still... is somewhat the case. I know you can pretty much live wherever you want now. They were lamenting the fact that the Klan system is somewhat breaking down now, that it's not quite as strong as it used to be, and that, of course...
I was not aware of that. When I came here and they first started talking about the Klan system, I thought it was probably as strong as ever. But then I asked that question myself back again during the times of the political,
yeah,
you know, we just went through an election
right.
here,
like April,
and
so.
Yeah, and as a non-Indian, and especially as James Billy's secretary, I had to be very careful that I didn't get involved or
mm-hmm.
reflect any kind of political anything, and but I did have questions because I'd see things coming up. So when I could get him to side, say, well, I want to ask you something. You know, I can see this one campaigning for that one, and thinking that the clans were supporting each other, and then trying to get, I'd hear somebody say, well, you know, this one is the head of that so-and-so clan, and they're going to swing all that clan's votes to this, or that clan's the largest clan, and so-and-so's of that clan, so they're going to swing all the votes. Is that really the way it works? And at that time, uh-huh. I think what he said to me was that the clan system was not that strong now, and that about, I think one of the only things possibly that was being used, the clan system was being used, was just not for the bloodline for marriages.
Mm-hmm. Not to marry within the clan. And yeah. Even that, they say that there's been a few inter-clan marriages.
Probably, yeah.
What were the issues in the campaign this year? Like, were people concerned? What were they concerned about? Because that may really help us with what we focus on.
I don't really know. You can ask Ethel more about that. I tried desperately and was successful. In fact, James asked me one day. He was in. He's a very complex person.
Yeah.
But he said to me one day, they were talking about somebody's stand on something, and he turned around to me and he says, "Well, what's my platform?" And I said, "Man, I don't know. I'm just typing." And he started laughing. He said, "Good work. Keep it up, you know." Because he didn't want me to be involved.
Yeah.
And I couldn't be involved.
No, it would have been terrible.
So I didn't. I avoided. I did not ever hear him speak from a political platform. I never heard a political speech. I never attended any of the functions. And all of his political campaigning was all done out of his home. His wife even scheduled all the stuff. I was not involved in that at all. I even volunteered one time to peel potato salad. She said, "This is one time, the last thing I need is a non-Indian involved. Just do your typing."
Yeah.
Said, "You know, fine." And that's exactly the way it went. I kept the office going, and, you know, as far as communicating back and forth with him, with what was happening here as far as the programs, how things were running here, but politics, we just didn't. And it worked out great because I could have been a bigger hindrance to, a much greater hindrance to him than I could have ever been a help on the political thing. So I stayed completely out of it. And
well, we're glad that that's over with.
Yes, we are.
Because if we were,
we're very
well,
glad.
I don't think it would be possible for us to do this if it was, you know, in the campaign time. Because I'm sure it was. Just
no,
like,
you know. It was crazy.
Yeah,
I think it got crazy here around the middle of February, stayed crazy. I mean, it stayed crazy for about 2 weeks after the election, and then things really started to calm down a bit. Back to the normal run of things.
Uh huh. Well, can you think of any questions?
What are some of the major projects that Jim Billing has lined up for the future, like things he really wants to work on with the tribe?
From hearing him speak to the staff after the election and everything, I think the education, again, is, like most other leaders, I think education is about his number one priority. And then economic development, he's still very strong on that. He feels that the tribe has come thus far until just the last couple of years when the bingo got involved and the cigarette money got involved, primarily with government grants and things like that. And he feels that that it's just not there. I mean, I think a lot of Indian people feel that the government owes me this and the government owes me that. Well, from hearing him talk, you know, so the government owes it to you. But it's not a bottomless pit. You've got to stand up for yourself. He's very independent, and he mm-hmm. thinks everybody ought to be.
Right.
I mean, you know, he doesn't feel like he's a social program. You know, if you can work, get out there and get a hammer and get started. And he can, I've seen him get some of these guys and work them to a pulp when he was developing the Tampa
right.
reservation. I mean, those boys would call down here, "Where is he? I think he's heading your way." Oh, you know, and they're gone. Because he would work as hard as they would work.
Mm-hmm.
He'd get out there in the crack of dawn and be pounding and hammering and hollering and really going. But he feels that the tribe can't stand back and depend on the government. He even feels that the tribe can't depend on cigarettes and bingo.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, where does bingo stand in terms of economic development?
Well,
other avenues of thought does he have as far as developing?
Well, they're working on some farming projects, some agricultural things.
Uh-huh.
Big Cypress has been very successful. Last year was their first year of an agricultural project, and mm-hmm. they were they had peppers that were this big.
Oh, so
they were really
doing, like,
truck
peppers,
farming.
And yeah,
tomatoes.
No, see, peppers. I think it was peppers and cucumbers and watermelon, I believe, mm-hmm. they did last year. And Brighton Reservation is working on a citrus project. Mm-hmm. And I think he's trying to get the tribe to go into other avenues of business that would not quite be so controversial.
How mm-hmm. has cattle ranching played in with the economic development?
From what I can gather, the ranching has more supported the individual people. It was not done. It's not being done as a tribal project. It's been individual cattlemen
yeah.
that got their start back during the time when I think the Bureau of Indian Affairs funded them,
yeah.
and they got their first cattle. So it's been more to individual
yeah.
groups.
That's the same then with the arts and crafts. That's an individual enterprise.
As a tribe as a whole or as a project?
Well,
that
the arts and crafts, the people who are doing the arts and crafts receive financial rewards back from their personal craft sales.
Yes.
Is that how that's set?
Okay, well, see, like in with Ethel's project now, I don't want to get confused with that.
Okay.
That's part of that, I think, is funded through the state program. And I'm not sure exactly how that works. But individual craftsmen throughout the tribe that are not affiliated with Ethel's project buy the supplies themselves. They find their own outlet. There's not a centralized outlet for their crafts. Now, that village, I mean, that particular thing, if they want to come in and they want to buy it, but it's not where they're obligated to buy. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, what is the arts and crafts up here?
The arts and crafts up here, that building and that project has been one of the outlets that they have had. But
mm-hmm.
And the Tampa Reservation has opened an arts and crafts
right.
center, and that's been another outlet that they've had. But I think that they have sold, some sell individually. I understand that there's on this... there's a boat, some kind of boat tour thing that
mm-hmm.
goes out. I can't even think of the name of it. But and they go to a little island. They have alligator wrestling, and some people out there sell some of the crafts. So the craftsmen are individual people that work. If they want to work today and make $5, and you come along and you want to buy three of them and he wants two, then they sell them. They set their own price. There's no guild, per se, that they work out of or
right.
that everything is screened through. I think, again, that's something that's coming that may come to pass in another 4 or 5 years. But I think that they're still, I say, behind us as a culture for organizing and getting things going. But then sometimes I think they're way ahead of us. Way ahead of us. So
yeah. Well, that's why a lot of them, I guess, go to festivals and things
right.
and sell their own crafts.
Right,
but
right. They're individual.
Just, yeah.
Well, then, with Ethel at Immokalee, that Arts and Crafts Center and what she's doing there is pretty unique compared to the other reservations. She's making an attempt to actually teach and train the people that are there.
I'm not sure. I know that's funded under the Florida Governor's Council.
Uh-huh.
And the purpose... I'm not real sure what the purpose of the project was to be. If it was to teach and to keep the craft going, I think that could be very much be what it was. To teach the craft to some of the other people, then the products that they made during the teaching, and I think the state supplies them with a certain amount of materials and so forth. And then they resell it, and then that money goes back into the kitty to buy more supplies to go. And I think Ethel gets some type of a salary of some sort
mm-hmm.
from that project.
What do you think the future is of crafts within the tribe 5 years from now or 10 years from now? What direction do you see that going in?
Well, I would be concerned from my limited knowledge, because you're getting into that same group of people that only speaks English. It's that generation of people that are coming along in 10 years,
yeah.
5, 10 years. Not that many of them know any of the crafts. Okay, for instance, Donna Frank, she's really an exception to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
She's young, and she's an excellent craftsman. Okay?
But isn't that directly from the influence of Big Sister?
And mother, and her mother. And there's not that many people around here. The younger girls that are, say, my age, I would venture to say that you won't find, I may be wrong now, again, this is with my exposure, but I'd say five craftsmen in the group of three of them to be good. You know, I don't think there's that many of them. Now, the younger ones, I mean, I think it's like most everything else. As the culture, you know, the group gets older, the older ones are dying off, and some of the younger ones are picking it up, but not in the same
Yeah. Right. What do the young people want? What are their interests? Like the high school age kids right now, what are their goals, if you can say?
I really can't say. I'd be confused to even know if they have goals at this point. You know, I know some of them do. I'm not really, I don't have that many of them pass through here, you know, and I'm not that involved with the educational department that would be in more contact with these kids. But
let me ask you something, too. I know that in Porky's, quite a few Seminoles from the tribe were represented in that movie. Like, just totally off the wall. How was that received?
Well, believe it or not, I think you're talking to the Porky's expert. I was the one they contacted and they put it together to get the people, and that was a riot too, because trying to deal with them as one group and to try to mesh between that non-Indian entity that's used to everybody jumping and being on time and doing just what they were told when they were told to do, and then with this group who they don't use clocks and. Mm-hmm. Oh, that was real riot.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've been surprised. I was surprised at first. A lot of them were interested. They were curious, and I think that's where you got a lot of the involvement. They were paid, and it was a small amount. I think it was like $35 a day, except for Betty Mae Jumper, and the ones that received the credits at the end of the film.
And Betty Mae was right out there on the
front. My husband laughed at me, you know, and because I'm reading all the credits. You know, the movie's over, and I'm reading the credits, and he says, "What, are you going to go home tonight?" And I said, "Hey, I got to see the very bottom line, you know." And I was glad I stayed, because I did get to see Betty Mae and them's name, you know, as one of them.